Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
98FM. Now that's what I call sport podcast.
Very happy to welcome Michael Owen to the studio. Michael, how are you?
Good day, I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, great, thanks a million for coming in. Michael, of course, former Liverpool, Real Madrid, Newcastle, Man United, Stoke and England striker. Over 200 goals for club and country in 450 appearances or so. The Ballon d'Or in 2001 and England's youngest ever player and scorer at the time. He played in the World Cups in 98, 02 and 06 and also Euro 2000 and 2004. Retired at the end of 2013 season. And since then, he owns horses, he's a BT Sport pundit and he's written his new book, which is called Michael Owen Reboot, My Life, My Time. And just been in Easons on O'Connell Street doing a signing. And Michael, it's fair to say you're still a popular man here in Dublin.
Oh, it's been great. Great to meet the people and sign a few books today. I'm a regular visitor, really, of course, as you mentioned, in the horse racing world. I suppose Ireland is top of the tree. So we come over for sales, we come over for racing. And it's always great to be here.
I'm always interested when a footballer or a sports person writes a book and they pick the name. And the name is Reboot. Why did you name it that?
Well, we got given a couple of choices. I think everybody tried to knock their heads together. Of course, my job was to get the content in the middle of the book. But of course, with the colours, with the title, everything else, that was sort of put to us. What do you think? We got a couple of different options, and I thought Reboot sounded a decent enough name. So yeah, I'll give the creative designers the credit for that, though.
Yeah, and a huge amount of work, you know, in these books in terms of your ideas and you putting your ideas onto paper or maybe to someone who's going to help you write the book. And you know, I went through there the clubs you've played for and you know, a short overview of what you've done, but how was it actually thinking back to all of that and putting it into a book?
Well, part of it was quite therapeutic, actually, just going through my whole life again. The process of writing a book is a long one, I must admit. I mean, I did about 3 6-hour sessions and then about another dozen hour phone calls, you know. And then, of course, once you get all that was probably the main content. Then you've got to read through it all again. Then, of course, you start thinking about, I forgot to say this story or that story. So little anecdotal little stories that I started adding in later on. I think I've encapsulated everything. There's nothing really that I've missed, I don't think. But it's an interesting process. And of course, once you start reading it, you think, oh, that's going to make a headline here, or that's going to, you know, maybe interest a few people. And overall, it's been an honest account of my life. And I hope everybody enjoys it.
Yeah, they do indeed. And I love as well the images in different books, and had Shay Given in here a couple of years ago, and just he was talking me through some of the pictures in the book and how he chose them and how the people helping him write the book chose them, and that every picture had a story to tell. And again, in this book, there's different photos from across your career, from when you were a young fella to when you were an elder fella.
Yeah, Shay Given's actually in there, I think. I think for Manchester United fans out there, it was him in goal when I scored that last minute injury time. And I think the picture's actually in it. Someone was showing me at the book signing today. In fact, I signed the actual picture, so that's good. But yeah, I think a cross-reference of lots of different pictures from childhood to obviously to my playing days to what I do off the pitch. So I think it's good to have a few pictures in there just so people can almost paint the picture themselves of the story.
Yeah, now, Michael, I'm a massive Liverpool fan, right? And our show here on 98FM is sponsored by the LFC store and the ILAC Centre, so it's a great guest to have. My first ever Premier League football game was in Anfield, around 99, Liverpool-Barnsley. I think you were wearing the old, you know, that like cream old Liverpool jersey with the Carlsberg thing. Went to a couple of my uncles and my cousins, and I fell in love with Liverpool there and then. And that was a great time to be a football fan. I was only 10 at the time. What do you remember about those early Liverpool days when very, very quickly you became a cup hero? You know, I'm not going to say almost overnight because you've been at the academy, but when you came to the first team, straight away they were like, my God, we love him.
Well, it was, what did I think about him? It's simply the best years of my career, those early days. In fact, coming through the ranks, you know, when you're 9, 10, 11, playing for your county, playing for your club, playing for your local team, they were all great because not a care in the world. And of course, when you get into the first team as well, it starts getting serious, but it's so much fun as well. I'd say it was still, it's always been fun. Football's been my life. It was less fun once I started getting injuries and I felt my pace going halfway through my career. But up until the ages of sort of around 24, 25, I mean, it was just amazing. The best life you could hope for, really.
When did you realise that you were so quick? And there's so many goals. I was looking this morning on YouTube, some of your best goals and the pace for England, for Liverpool, for all of your clubs, really. I know you said you had some hamstring trouble later in your career, but when did you realise as a kid, I'm a striker and I'm so quick?
Well, I knew playing, you know, as a 7, 8, 9 year old that I was fast. But then I went to school and, do you know, I still thought I was quick. I was still the quickest in my sort of junior school. But then we went to high school and then we started going to county races. And I was always miles clear after sort of 50, 60 metres and never won. I couldn't sustain the sprint for sort of all the big lads when I was only 13, 14 would start catching me up in the last few metres. So I knew I had raw speed, but not sort of top end, like a galloping speed, let's say. So football distances, that was my thing, you know, 10 metres here, 20, 30 metres, chop change in direction and balance. So I was football fast, let's say. And again, if I raced anybody really over 50 metres, I would have fancied myself. But 100 metres, believe it or not, was probably a bit too far for me.
Yeah, and you played, you know, in a team at that time that sometimes played with two strikers and it was always a bigger player with you, whether it be Emil Heskey or Robbie Fowler or those type players. And I was sitting with my mate last night having a pint and saying I was going to interview him, and he was like, my God, it's Michael Owen. And he wanted me to ask you this. The other Liverpool strikers he never played with, Suarez, Fernando Torres, Salah, those type of fellas. If you could pick one strike partner to go back in time to Anfield now and play with of those players or others that you never played with at Liverpool, who would you pick and why?
Oh, what a question that is. I mean, I think if you ask the Liverpool fans who's, you know, who's the best, Suarez, Salah, Torres, I mean, it would literally be an even split, I would say. I mean, Torres was unbelievable for a period of time. Well, basically at Liverpool, for, you know, a few years at Liverpool, he was unbelievable. Suarez, I thought, was as good as I've seen, really, for a patch of time going to Anfield. I mean, it was genuinely exciting going to watch him. But then I'd maybe he's not sustained that as well at Barcelona, maybe. I'd say he was just unplayable at Liverpool. Salah's obviously a joy to watch as well. I don't know. I think if I had to pick one, I might just side on Suarez.
Oh, I thought you'd say Torres.
Yeah, I think I'd just side on Suarez. I think Torres had more natural ability probably, but God, the sheer ruggedness and streetwise, oh, he was just a beast to watch, Suarez.
And would you and Suarez be a good partnership, given, I said again to my mate Sean last night, that I think you'd both be quite similar in terms of how you want to play, and it might be better to have a Torres, you know, who was brilliant but bigger and more of a target man, like the Heskey-Fowler partnership, or could you and Suarez do a, I'm sure you could do a great job together.
Well, they say opposites attract, don't they, in life, and I think it's exactly the same with centre-forwards, which is why I had such, you know, good games, and probably my best partnership was with Emil Heskey. We were totally the opposite. Then if you go to play with similar players, and I would say all those players that we've mentioned, the Fowlers, the Torres, the Suarez, the Salah, they're all hungry. They're all obsessed by goals, and so was I. So I think we'd be end up chasing the same balls. Of course, you can make it work, but it's not as pretty on the eye. And I think the opposites, as I say, are the successful partnerships over the years have been that, you know, go right back to the Dalglishan rushes, you know, Shearer, Sheringham's, Bergkamp's and Ian Wright's and players like that, York and Cole. So I think it probably would have taken a little bit of work to play with one of those great players.
So in 2001, Liverpool win the League Cup, the FA Cup and the UEFA Cup at the time, and you win the Ballon d'Or, which is the best football player in Europe, and you would have been early 20s then, yeah?
Yeah.
What do you remember about that season and that award and the night of the awards and just being named the best in the business?
Well, nowadays it's brilliant. You know, I must admit, you know, when I look at my trophy cabinet and I see that golden ball spinning around, it sends a shiver down your spine. You see the winners over the last few years, it's basically Messi and Ronaldo for the last 10 years or something. But the names on the trophy are just frightening. When I look back and see the names beneath me in that year of the voting was frightening. You know, the Zidanes, the Raúls, the Ronaldinhos, the Ronaldos, there's, you know, Beckhams. Everyone was on it, it seems. So it was brilliant. But at that time, I just didn't view it like that. I mean, I was so obsessed with the next thing. And I remember getting presented with the trophy at Anfield, and everybody was there clapping, and you know, and some chap was handing me the award, and I was just, you know, get off the pitch, you know. I smile with the trophy, and I almost was wanting to push him off the pitch and come on, let's get on with the game, because there was a, you know, I was so obsessed with scoring, winning. It's the next trophy. I never really sat there and thought, oh, that's a great thing to win. And I think the people, with all due respect, I think the people that think like that are never the successful ones. If you sit there and think, oh, pat yourself on the back and how good was that, let's spend a couple of weeks reflecting and how beautiful and all the rest of it. You know, people aren't like that, or successful people aren't like that. It's the next thing. Right, I've won it. Now I need to win it again. Now there's a game tomorrow. I need to score a hat-trick type of attitude. And that's exactly what I was, but thankfully I've mellowed a bit now.
You're on there. That's What I Call Sport on 98FM. It's Jamie Moore here on Sunday in studio with Michael Owen, the former Liverpool and England striker, of course, played as well for Real Madrid, Newcastle, Man United and Stoke City, about his new autobiography, which is called Reboot. And it's a great read, available in all good bookstores right now. And if you'd like to have a little look behind the scenes, we can do a quick video with Michael now during his next answer for our Instagram page, Michael, if that's all right. So don't get distracted by the phone. Real Madrid, and you moved there in 2004 for a fee of £8 million, which is a very small fee when you compare the fees that people are going for now. You spent a year there, and again last night, like Iker Casillas, Roberto Carlos, Zinedine Zidane, Raul, the bigger Ronaldo, not Cristiano, the Brazilian Ronaldo. David Beckham was at the club at the time, and those days Sky Sports every Sunday was La Liga, Los Galacticos, Real, Barcelona, and you're playing for like Los Galacticos. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, that was the dilemma, really. All those players that you've just mentioned, when I heard that Real Madrid were interested in me, I never wanted to leave Liverpool, but I was just thinking, core, I can't say no to this. This is just an unbelievable opportunity to play with some great players, play in that stadium, different language, weather, food, just a new life. And just to try it, I would have probably regretted it all my life if I had said no. And despite me to-ing and fro-ing, I eventually thought, I convinced myself actually that it'll be all right. You can always go back to Liverpool. I even shook the chief exec's hand, Rick Parry, at the time at Liverpool, and said, you know, in a year or two, we'll reconvene, so to speak. So that was a decision made to go out there for all those reasons. And it was amazing. I did have a great time. I scored loads of goals, made loads of friends. It was, you know, something that I can look back on with fond memories. The only sad bit of it was that I couldn't, you know, piece together, or none of us could, you know, an opportunity to get back to Liverpool. But hey ho, that was how life worked, and it sent me on another journey. And do you know what? I had enjoyed some of that other journey as well.
What was it like playing in El Gran Clásico, Real Madrid, Barcelona, and the Bernabeu in comparison to the Nou Camp, and just those games, and the two best teams in Spain, massive crowds, and it meant you were used to Liverpool, Everton and so on, but it meant so much to the people there, and one of the biggest football matches in the world.
It is, I would probably say, the biggest club football game in the world. I remember we played our first game in the Nou Camp, and travelling to the ground, and it just seemed like their fans lined the streets for miles and miles, and everything was hitting our bus. Our windows were all shattered. All the players were sort of huddled together down the aisle of the bus, and the atmosphere was just, you know, so tense, so aggressive towards us. And Barcelona were an amazing team at the time. They beat us 3-0. I came on for half an hour, and it was my first experience of El Clásico. We then played them at Bernabeu. And I started in this game, and I mean, I always remember looking up at the scoreboard after I'd scored, and you look at the players that had scored. I think it was Zidane, Raul, Ronaldo, Owen, Ronaldinho and Eto'o. I mean, it was six players or five great players and myself up there at the time. It was just not pinch yourself type of thing, but it was, you just think, yeah, that's the reason I came over here. The stadium was so loud. It was amazing. I mean, the locals were just so passionate about football. It was an amazing day.
And you say that, and you're playing in the game, and you're actually looking at the scoreboard on the pitch. And I always wonder this at the Aviva Stadium last week for the Irish games, and like when the big screen goes onto a player, they've missed a chance. I always look on, are they looking at the replay on the screen? Are they looking at themselves on the screen and so on? And do they ever, you know, have a moment to go, I'm actually playing in this massive match? And you were saying you're actually on the pitch, you've scored the goal, you're looking up going, there's the scoreboard and there's my name with all of these amazing players.
Well, you don't really look at it and think and pinch yourself.
Yeah.
Again, going back to it, if you think like that, then you're probably won't be in that type of occasion. You've got to accept that this is life and that you're part of it and a big part of it. Sometimes you'll just take a glance up to see how long's to go and things like that. And of course, if there's a replay and you missed a chance or whatever, or even if you scored the goal, you might want to take a sneaky peek to have another look again. So, yeah, there's very few times in football where you sort of come out of the zone, out of the mental zone. And as I say, sometimes just looking at a clock or whatever can distract you for a second. But in general, you're just so focused on the game.
So you move from Real Madrid and you can't go back to Liverpool, so you sign for Newcastle. And a story of you commuting to training via helicopter. And I'm not sure if you've heard of a guy called Jason Sherlock, right? He was a footballer. He nearly signed for Liverpool, but he played for the Dublin GAA team. And he was in here a couple of years ago about his book. And he was saying he once went from playing a soccer match in Dublin for Shamrock Rovers via helicopter up north to play a GAA match for the Dubs, a Gaelic football match. And it just reminded me of that story. And you were a man who 4 or 5 days a week was on a helicopter to go to football. Tell us about that.
Not quite. Okay. I did get one. And I think I'm at pains in the book to say, because of course lots of things get blown out of proportion, especially from my time at Newcastle. Yes, it's true. As soon as I came back from Madrid, one of the reasons we came back because we missed home, family, friends, and one of the reasons that I went to Newcastle is to think, right, well, it's closer to home. Days off, I can come home. You know, getting up from my family to come and watch me play. So, you know, getting a helicopter was something that actually, when I say it, I cringe a little bit because it sounds very big time and big headed and arrogant. But it was, we were away for a while and we are family, you know, orientated. So a lot of the time my family was on it, coming up, traveling up to watch me play. You know, as I say, I might go home once a week. And do you know, it was something that I would probably not do if I had my time again. Not, I mean, it helped practically. It was absolutely brilliant. I got to see people and they came to see me and all the rest of it. But just for perception, it just gives the wrong impression. So I'm disappointed that you can't do something that's actually meant to be a good thing just because you're in fear of people having a go at you. But that's the way of the world. So as I say, if I had my time again, I probably would have thought it through and just thought, nah, it's not worth the aggro, really.
So when you were playing for all of those clubs, really, I know towards the end social media had taken off a little bit more massively, and I mean, you're very active on Twitter, at the Michael Owen on Twitter, 3.8 million followers, and I don't want to go into the whole Alan Shearer story because you've spoken about it loads, but when you were playing back in the early days, would you have liked to have Twitter, Instagram, and how do you deal now with different people, whether you're on BT Sport or whether you're having a row with Alan Shearer or whether someone doesn't like something you said in the book? How do you kind of deal with that now? Do you run your own account, that sort of stuff? And when you were playing, when you were 18, 19, would you have liked to have social media?
Well, I do run my own social media, and I happen to think it's far better for players now. Yes, you take abuse, but you don't have to look at the, you know, your replies or anything else like that. You had no choice back in my day. I mean, the newspapers were very powerful. It was the only communication really with the fans. Even then, whatever you said would get twisted. Stupid headlines would come up. People would, you know, there was phone hacking at the time, so there was no secrets. No matter what you did, you know, you were always petrified that the press, on a Friday night, you were just scared that your agent was going to phone you and say, right, News of the World have said you've done this or done that, and or the Sunday Mirror or whatever newspaper at the time, and all of a sudden you're just thinking, oh no. So it was, you were looking over your shoulder all the time. It wasn't that pleasant. You know, you'd have turnips on your head one day and then you'd be the star on the back page the next day. At least now you're in control. Okay, you get a few idiots that have a go at you and whatever, but that's life. You don't have to read it. But in general, you are in control of your own destiny and whatever you want to put out there. You can create your own image. You can, you know, if you're a that type of person, you can get out there and show it, or you can switch it off. You don't even have to have it, you know, but you're certainly not dictated and bullied in many cases by outside influences nowadays.
So you signed for Man United from Newcastle, yeah? And again, I put up on my Instagram story yesterday about what questions people want to ask, and a question came in from a fella going, so the offer's on the table, you've been asked to sign for Man United, but you're a Liverpool legend and it's not the most done move to do, and you eventually sign and you do really well, you score the winner of the derby and so on. What's going through your head when the offer is there, but you know signing for United, having played for Liverpool for so long is not going to, shall we say, please a lot of people in Merseyside.
Exactly that went through my head. You know, I had three options. I left Newcastle. The first thing I did is pick the phone up to Brendan Rodgers. He already had, you know, Suarez and, you know, Sterling.
We could have had that partnership we spoke about if he had said yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So it wasn't for the want of trying. Of course, I tried to get back to Liverpool. That was my club. I saw it as my club. So in answer to that, that's what I did. First port of call. Now, once Liverpool say no, because of various reasons, and they're well within the rights, of course, to say no, I didn't have a God-given right to go back there, then it's about, right, what do you want to do? You know, you're mid to late 20s, you've got a career ahead of you, you've got to play for the best team possible, the best experience, the best life choice. You know, I've got four children. Ideally, it'd be fantastic to be able to live at home again. And then we looked at who was in Hull City, Everton, Manchester United. They were the three teams that showed an interest. With all due respect, I thought Hull was a step down. I didn't really want to be fighting relegation. I thought my level was a bit better than that. And then, what can you do? I was going to get
stick.
You're
picking Man United or Everton.
I was going to get stick or whatever, and I probably rolled my eyes and thought, how's my luck? In saying that, you know, I make no apologies for picking who I picked, Manchester United. I knew a lot of players there. I mean, I was intrigued to play under a great manager, great stadium, you know, huge fan base. It was just so many boxes ticked. The only negative was that I knew I was going to infuriate a section of Liverpool fans. Part of me thought, surely people can understand, you know. You might jump ship and go to a different station tomorrow if it's a better life opportunity, you know, better for your family, better for all of these things. In any other walk of life, people pat you on the back and say, do you know what? Congratulations, that's a great move, great promotion, you've done well, you know, you've now got a better package, whatever that might be, as I say, whether it's where you live or a longer contract or more money or whatever that might be. But if it's in football, it's just the rules are different because football fans are just one track mind and it's their team, no one else, and they can't sort of understand sometimes, I guess, some of them. So that was that. I had to stay on top of my game. I had to be the best club, hopefully, training and playing with the best players, and that was my decision.
How would you describe the pressure of playing for England, and did you enjoy that?
I loved it. I didn't feel pressure. Pressure for me is when you're asked to do something and you're not sure you can do it. Put a million people in front of me scoring a goal, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. I know I can do it. It doesn't matter, you know, what the exterior is, you know, how many people or anything else like that. That's not pressure. There are a lot of players that I played with that played worse for their country as opposed to their club, which is concerning in many ways. And, you know, obviously they'll have to answer that. But I honestly think that I played equally as well for my club as I did for my country. I had great moments for both. Yes, there was pressure on England to do well because we had such a good team, but I never went out onto the pitch scared or running away from the ball or hiding. I just, you know, I always took responsibility.
Michael, we're a little tight for time, so if we can just finish on three more, if that's okay. You retired at the end of the 2012-13 season and we're kind of 5-6 years on now. Tell me about the horses and your interest in them. When did that start and how much of a part of your life is it now, given that you're not a footballer anymore?
Well, I've always been interested. My dad was interested and sort of my passion grew for it. I first bought my first horse when I was 18. I got back from the World Cup. I called it Etienne Lady after the goal I scored in St. Etienne. And that passion just grew. One horse became two became four became six. And then when I was about 25, 26, I thought, this is something that I really enjoy. I want to do it for the rest of my life. I have it as a passion outside of football. And I set up my own little business, bought a farm, put a gallop in, made some stables, and that was that. We started with 20 horses. Roll on 15 years to where we are now. We now train about 100 horses. Wow. The business is really good. It's flying. I just love the environment. I love the people involved. So many interesting characters, socialising. The whole thing is just a total, you know, relaxation from my day job, which remains football. I mean, I still advise a lot of young players, sort of mentor them. I do 70 days on the television doing broadcast. I've got a physio business. I've got lots of different little businesses, but my racing is certainly something that I love. If I get a day off, then you'll definitely see me down at the stables.
What goes into naming a horse? You have 100 horses, so you name one. Etienne Lady, was it?
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, I went horse riding, and the horse I was riding was called Sully, and I never knew why it was called Sully. And anyway, I haven't rode horses in years and years and years. But every week on the radio, we're talking about the races, and you're going through the horses' names, and you're like, God, they're so creative, but where do they come from? And you've got 100 of them. You haven't named them all yourself, surely.
Well, no, they're not all my 100, but obviously they're in my business. Yeah. We've got a lot of clients that send their horses to us. I think a lot of are named after family members or things like that. I mean, I've called one Brown Panther my best horse that actually had his swan song here, winning the Irish St. Ledger was amazing. But I called him Brown Panther because when he was born, I went to visit him the next day at the stud farm, and he walked out and he had his head between his legs as if he was stalking his prey, you know, out in the wild.
Yeah.
And the chap said to me, he said, look at that. He sort of keeps his head. He's like a panther. So he was named after a day of being born, but most of them I name after my children or my family. Or I called one Treble Heights because her mum was called Height of Passion, and we had just won the treble. So there's loads of different ways. That's one of the fun things about owning horses.
So of the 100 horses, how many of them do you know their name? All of them? Like when you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's my business.
Go on.
How long have we got?
Not long. Well.
No, we got some good horses. I mean, we got a horse called Catchy that was a top sprinter for the last few seasons. He's brilliant. He's one of the stable stars. Horse called Great Scott came sixth or seventh in the Guineas, English Guineas this year. He just won a big race at Haydock last week. I mean, we've got some really nice horses, and the business is flying at the moment.
And I'm sure you become very, very attached and close to the horses. And then when they get older and they die or they get sick and they can't race and whatever, that has to be very hard given you're so interested in it and you're so attached to them.
Well, yeah, we look after a lot of ex-race horses at my house. So my stables is about half an hour from home. But when they retire, if we own them, we either, you know, keep them and look after them, we breed from them. So yeah, we're all very attached to them, and I've got four kids, and every Saturday and Sunday morning it's their job to get into the buggy and drive out into the paddocks and feed them. So all my family get attached to all the horses, and of course when they're racing it's hard work for them. They're at the farm, but before they turn into racehorses and afterwards, then they're pampered to death at my house.
Nice. And you mentioned as well 70 days a year on TV, mainly on BT Sport. How do you find that? And being a football pundit has changed and will continue to change given the age of what it is and what the fans want, and also the companies and the technology that they can give you. So getting to see some of the great games, I'm sure it's great, but how are you commenting on managers maybe you've worked with, players you've worked with, and you know, maybe sometimes being critical of people when, if you put your shoes in their position, you may go, when you were playing, well, I didn't like Andy Gray saying this about me, and now you have to be the one that says it about others.
Well, there's no doubt that if you're 50-50 on a player, a lot of pundits will sort of err on the side of, well, I know him, he's my mate, I don't really want to have a go at him, I guess. I mean, you try to be as honest as you can. Sometimes you give a real strong opinion on something that gets twisted into negatives. I mean, the recent one is I was asked whether Rashford can score 30 goals a season, and I said I think he's a world-class player. Manchester United will, you know, should build a team around him, but is he obsessed with scoring goals? Is he going to be a 30-goal man? And I don't think he is. I think he'll always contribute 20-odd, but I watched him as an academy player. I know the coaches that coached him. I mean, nobody ever says he was that hungry player that sat in the box and preyed on goals. He liked playing wide. He liked playing as number 10. It's only my opinion. But I still think he's world-class, and I still think he's got an amazing touch, and he's absolutely rapid and all these great things. But you can just take from my answer then a total negative, make a back page story saying Michael Owen doesn't think Rashford's, you know, the number 9 that should carry Manchester United forward. And that happens all the time. So, but that's life. That's the life I've chosen to go down, the work I've chosen to go down. I'm honest with my assessment on players. I've just given an example on Rashford. Half the time people will twist it and put it as a negative, but sometimes you can say a positive thing and sometimes a negative thing. It's just how I view it.
And lastly, Michael, you're 39, and I was going to say, how's retirement? But clearly the amount of stuff you're doing, you're not retired. You're retired from playing football, but you've got the horses, you've got your book, you've got BT Sports, you've got the physio, you've got lots of other stuff too. Do you enjoy life as much now as a former footballer with all that's going on, or if I could say to you, you're going back to be 18 again and making that Liverpool debut.
And you haven't got kids
and you haven't got a wife. I know it's not going to happen, but like, they're two very different lives, and you seem to have enjoyed one and you are enjoying the other.
Yeah, I mean, my best days were, if you could rewind the clock and say 18 again, smacking the ball in the back of the net at will, it was those were the best years of my life. But they have to stop at some point. Everybody gets older. Everybody, you know, their powers wane a little bit and someone comes in and takes your place. But all things considered now, as somebody that's retired, I've built a lovely sort of life for myself. You know, I still work in football. I've got outside of football, I've got an interest. I've got four children. Everyone's healthy and happy. So, I mean, I couldn't grumble with how things have panned out post-football.
Great stuff, Michael Owen. The book is called Reboot, My Life, My Time. Thank you very much for your time in studio today and the best of luck.
Brilliant. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
98 FM. Now that's what I call sport. Get the full show every Sunday morning from 9, only on 98 FM.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.